Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at cindysheehansoapbox.com, communityprogressiveradio.org, or from iTunes. I'm still so excited about iTunes and proud of myself for putting my show up there all by myself, as my grandchildren would like to say, the ones who are 2 years and above. I'm going to do it all by myself. I didn't want to put my show on iTunes all by myself, but I actually had to figure it out by myself. So yay for me. Our guest today will be talking about Syria. He has made a film about Syria called Syria Between Iraq and a Hard Place, and that's Iraq for you Americans, Between Iraq and a Hard Place. And he also has done a lot on Cuban-American relations and the Cuban Five, so we'll be talking to him about that also. Saul Landau, our guest, is an internationally known scholar, author, commentator, and filmmaker on foreign and domestic policy issues. He's won many awards, and I'm going to be posting his bio on my website, and I'm going to be linking it to the show so we can all read his extensive bio. He's made over 40 films. He's written over 14 books. And like I said, he's gotten many awards. He's Professor Emeritus at California State University, Pomona. He's a senior fellow at and vice chair of the Institute for Policy Studies. Our dear soapbox friend, Gore Vidal, rest in peace, said, "Saul Landau is a man I love to steal ideas from." Saul Landau, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Well, thanks for having me, Cindy.
Oh, it's nice to finally have you on the show. We're going to talk about a subject that's very important to me and I'm very interested in, and that's Cuban-American relations and the Cuban Five. But first, you're a noted filmmaker. You've won many awards, and you've made many films. But I noticed you made one called Syria Between Iraq, or, you know, most people in America call it Iraq, Between Iraq and a Hard Place. So can you talk about what's happening in Syria right now? It's like it's a hot spot right now.
Yes. Well, I mean, the Syrian government is not, how should we say it, the ideal democratic government. In fact, it's dictatorial and it's corrupt. But nevertheless, under the Assad regime, both the father and the son, there has been religious tolerance and a really pronounced stability. And you could see women had the right to education and were getting educated. Women served as doctors, engineers, and other professionals, and could wear Western dress. You didn't have Sharia law. You didn't have any of the religious fundamentalism that prevails in some of the nearby countries. But Syria also was hit by a profound economic crisis a few years ago, and the Assad government really did not respond adequately, so that there was very legitimate room and reason for protest. However, this protest took on new dimensions, really, when armed groups began shooting at Syrian members of the militia or armed forces or police. And now it's become well documented that a lot of these members of the Free Syrian Army are not Syrian at all. They're coming from Chechnya, they're coming from Libya, and they are armed by Saudi Arabian money and some of the Western nations as well. And indeed, and some of these people are very close or members of Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups. So it's very odd that the United States has put $45 million into the support for the Free Syrian Army when members of that force literally do belong to groups allied with Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And this, to my mind, is the key factor that people should know. First of all, we should not intervene in Syria. No nation should. This is the Syrian people have trouble with their government. They should be allowed to settle it. And the West should not be arming people or paying to arm them or providing them with any money or goods that relate to this law. This is not proper behavior. And of course, it's also self-defeating, as we've just seen in Libya, where, again, you have the rise of groups linked to al-Qaeda, who may very well have been connected to the assassination of the U.S. ambassador in Benghazi. So do we want the same thing to happen in Syria? It's like we're providing money to have our own throat cut. It's crazy. And we should just stop it. Let the Syrians deal with this on their own. Let them settle this. No more arms to the opposition. And I think if that was applied, I think that the people who are supplying the Syrian government would stop, and they would come to the table and might be able to settle this whole thing. I mean, that, to my mind, is logical.
Well, what really distresses me, of course, is in Libya, so many people on, you know, the so-called left here in this country supported it because they said that Gaddafi was killing his own people or whatever, you know. But then the UN and allied forces, but of course we know that the UN and NATO, they're just arms of U.S. foreign policy aggression. But they, people were saying that I didn't care about the Libyans because I didn't want a humanitarian intervention. But we know that tens of thousands of Libyans were killed by U.S. UN intervention, their humanitarian intervention. But to me, it's like, if you really care about the liberation of these people, instead of, you know, sending millions, if not billions of dollars, and these bombs, you know, raise up something like the Lincoln Brigade and go down there and fight tyranny if you think that's really what's important.
Well, it's totally hypocritical. I mean, the government of Bahrain was killing its own people, but that's where U.S. base is, so we don't want to mess around there. And the Saudis were doing a lot of the killing for the Bahrainis. And indeed, the Saudi Arabians don't exactly have a shining human rights record. Women, most women don't even have the right to drive a car in Saudi
right.
Arabia. And
right.
Indeed, if they show a piece of their flesh, even you know, a flash of ankle, they can get whipped by the religious police. But nothing is done there. So it's just hypocrisy. I mean, Gaddafi agreed, in fact, to dismantle his nuclear program, was fighting against the very kinds of terrorism that today are taking root in Libya. I mean, it's what happened was an insane act of stupidity against a man who was considered disobedient. I mean, and that's the real criteria, the rogue, so-called rogue governments, rogue meaning disobedient to Western desire. And, I mean, that's what we saw. I mean, when I was in Syria, some of the government officials would say, we have done so much to help the United States. And he was referring to the fact that the Syrian government was torturing people that the United States requested when they sent them there on rendition. And the Syrian government cooperated. The
right.
Syrian government tipped off the United States on possible attacks on their bases. And they said, how do you explain this contradiction in U.S. policy? And I just said, look, no good deed goes unpunished.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what else could one say?
Yeah, those were terrible, terrible deeds that the U.S.,
of course.
That Syria was cooperating with the U.S. on.
Yeah,
well,
they tortured Maher Arar, who was a Canadian Syrian.
Right.
When he was rendered from Kennedy Airport, he was on his way home from a vacation, and he was picked up at Kennedy Airport on his way to Canada. And instead of going home, the United States sent him to Syria, where he was tortured for a year. And then the Syrian said, the man has nothing to say. The United States accepted that, and he went back to Canada, where he won a very large suit against the Canadian government. He won several million dollars because the Canadians cooperated in this rendition. Anyway, that's the kind of things that the Assad government was doing to win favor with Washington. However, it didn't matter because the interest of the Assad government, which was in a sense some independence, did not coincide with Washington's desire to dominate. Israel, of course, is making a really stupid mistake because they had a viable truce with the Syrian government. That is, the Golan Heights, which is the disputed area, was not being used by Syria to start monkey business. And very foolishly, the Israelis backed this intervention policy as well. I think that if a new government emerged from this civil war that's now engulfing Syria, one would see a very right-wing jihadist government that might even apply Sharia law.
So, Saul, that gives us a good transition from the Middle East to Cuba and your movie, your most recent movie called Will the Real Terrorists Please Stand Up? So can you tell us about your newest movie? It's not exactly new, but your latest movie and the connection it has with terrorism in Cuba and, back to our own shores.
Well, I think if one looks at the history of U.S.-Cuban relations since Cuba's revolution in January 1959, one sees terrorism as a major theme that has emerged from that relationship. And it's been strictly one way. That is, terrorism practiced by the United States using Cuban exiles, in much of the instances, against Cuba, to the detriment of Cuba. Several thousand Cubans have been killed and many more wounded. Lots of property has been destroyed. The irony of this, of course, is that the United States has put Cuba on the terrorist list, the State Department's terrorist list, which makes no sense at all. I mean,
right.
If Cuba had a terrorist list, it would obviously put the United States first. Anyway, so the film attempts to capture essentially the history of those 53 years, which began in 59 and continues to this day as a very hostile relationship between two neighbors. And we use the actual people who did the terrorist acts, that is, these people who were living in Miami. We got interviews with them, and many of them boast about their accomplishments of, you know, bombing a civilian airplane or trying to assassinate Fidel Castro, or having overflights over Cuban territory. One of them concludes, however, that more than half a century has passed and we've accomplished absolutely nothing. There's more hatred and antagonism today than there ever was between the exile community and the island, and it was all useless. He quotes an old Spanish saying, you swim and swim and swim, and you end up dying on the shore. So, I mean, the film tries to portray the film through the mouths of the terrorists, using the footage, and using Cuban security people, on the other hand, some of whom captured or dealt with these people.
Right. So let's talk about the Cuban Five then and their relationship with these terrorist cells in Cuba. And we recently, you and I, participated in Toronto in a tribunal relating to the Cuban Five and terrorism in Cuba. My listeners, I think, are very well aware of the Cuban Five, but it's not something that is very well known here in the United States.
Well, the Cuban Five, of course, were five Cuban agents who volunteered on a mission to infiltrate some of the terrorist groups in Miami that were perpetrating bombings in tourist hotels, restaurants, bars, and clubs in Havana. The idea was infiltrate these groups and find out what their targets are, and then Cuban police can try to stop them. And then the Cubans were, ironically, sending the information to the FBI so that the FBI could then arrest the terrorists. But instead, the FBI arrested their sources, their own informers, which were the Cuban Five. And essentially, that began the story. Months later, the Justice Department charged them outrageously with conspiracy to commit espionage, albeit these men, they knew, had no interest in engaging in the theft or even search for strategic documents or anything related to U.S. national security. They were infiltrating terrorist groups in South Florida in the interest of stopping terrorism. Anyway, and one of them was charged with murder related to the shootdown by Cuban MiGs of intruding aircraft over Cuban airspace. That charge was even more absurd. Anyway, these five guys remain in prison. It's now 14 plus years that they served there, and they get very little attention in the U.S. media. And this is, of course, unjust, and we were together in Toronto at a conference to try to break that wall of silence that the media has essentially created.
Well, there hasn't just been a wall of silence. It's been a wall of silence accompanied by a barrage of propaganda. You know, recently we in the three of the Cuban Five international community found out that the U.S. government actually paid journalists to write propaganda about the case back before and during the trial.
Yes, before and during the trial. Several journalists were paid quite a bit of money, over hundreds of thousands of dollars, to write, put on radio and television shows to paint a negative picture of the defendants and of Cuba in general. In other words, designed to taint the community atmosphere, which would obviously affect the jury, so that no fair trial could be held in Miami. I mean, that was a given anyway, that the jury was intimidated. Photographers were photographing their car license plates so they could be identified, and so that every juror understood that if they foolishly voted for acquittal in this case, the best that could happen to them was that their houses would get firebombed. So you had an intimidated jury in a community where hostility was literally vibrating through the air. Remember, this community had just gone through the drama of Elian Gonzalez, the little boy who was found floating in the ocean after his mother had drowned on her way to the United States, and he was taken in by a great uncle who was very anti-Castro. But the father, a totally fit father, by the way, in Cuba, claimed the child, and all law, and I think President Clinton, as a former lawyer and law student, understood this totally. All law internationally and everywhere else naturally would have the child returned to his fit father.
Right.
And so after diddling around for a while, the Clinton administration finally decided to return the boy to his rightful father. And this caused a calamitous eruption in Miami, with huge demonstrations of 100,000 people, full of vitriol. And finally, Clinton had to send in an armed squad to get the little boy from his great-uncle's house. By the way, the great-uncle had two convictions for child molestation while he was in Cuba.
Wow.
This was not revealed, but the Cubans informed me of this. So he was hardly a fit guardian. Anyway, the child was returned. Miami was in a foul mood, that is the right-wing Cuban exile community, and they were holding up signs that said Castro's the number one terrorist, you know, Cuba sí, Castro no, stuff like that. This is what the atmosphere was like. And so the stupidity of anybody thinking that you could get a fair trial there, I mean, trying these five Cuban agents in Miami would have been the equivalent of trying five Jews in Berlin in 1938 under the Nazis. There was not a possibility of a fair trial. But all of the requests to change venue were denied by the judge, who must herself have been intimidated by the same forces. Anyway, so this was the atmosphere of the trial. And the judge sided continuously with the prosecution during the trial. And when the jury verdict predictably came in guilty, she sentenced the five to draconian lengths in prison. And an appeals court reversed those sentences and said they were overly harsh. And even when the resentencing suggestions were made by the appeals court, the original Riami judge went beyond them in resentencing, so that these guys have been sentenced to really long prison terms for fighting terrorism in Miami.
Well, let's talk about the real terrorists. Of course, I think that the U.S. government is the biggest state sponsor of terrorism around the world. But in your film particularly, like Luis Posada Carias and Orlando Bosch and Mas Canosa, these people, tell my listeners about them in the last few minutes we have left, and also about how they can find your film.
Okay. Well, to find the film is really easy. You can buy Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up at Amazon.com or at CinemaLibreStudioStore.com. Cinema Libre Studio is the distributor. Or you can stream it on Netflix. So it's Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up.
Okay, great.
The two men who did the bombing of a Cuban airliner in October of 1976, they hired two guys to plant bombs on a passenger plane, and the bombs were detonated over Barbados. The plane crashed into the sea, killing all 73 crew members and passengers on board. The two men who did this were Luis Posada Carriles and Orlando Bosch, both of whom are in the film. And Bosch identifies himself in the film as a crazy man.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's accurate. I think he was. He died last year. After having been honored at the University of Miami for his heroic contributions toward Cuban freedom.
Right.
Luis Posada also gets regularly honored for deeds like blowing up the airplane and orchestrating a bombing campaign in Cuba, one of which killed an Italian tourist. Now, Posada denies he did any one of these things, but he nevertheless accepts the honors that are given to him for the things he claims he didn't do. Very odd.
Also, he bombed an airplane, but is he in prison? Is Posada Carriles in prison?
Well, Posada Carriles lives in Miami.
Right.
Orlando Bosch is dead, and he was actually sprung from prison where he was in Venezuela for the uh-huh. airplane job by Daddy Bush, Bush 43, or 41 rather.
Uh-huh.
Against all the advice of the U.S. Justice Department and the FBI, who said that Orlando Bosch was a dangerous man, a terrorist, which is exactly what he was. But he called himself a freedom fighter. And in Florida, of course, anybody who does violence against Cuba is automatically known as a freedom fighter and gets honored and gets things named after him, which is a disgrace. I mean, it should be called the Autonomous Republic of Miami because it has its own foreign policy. And certainly
right.
its own judicial system.
Right.
Anyway, these people appear in the film along with Antonio Veciana, who was the CIA's choice to assassinate Castro. He tried on numerous occasions unsuccessfully. Veciana, at the end, is somewhat repentant about what he has done all these years because he sees it's useless. And the other one we have is Jose Basulto, who organized Brothers to the Rescue, supposedly initially to rescue rafters on their way from Cuba to the United States. But as soon as the migration treaty was signed between the United States and Cuba, that job ended, and he began carrying out overflights where he was dropping pamphlets over Havana. And then, according to one of the infiltrators, he had developed a new weapon that he was planning to drop into Cuba as well. And Cuba then warned the United States that they should revoke his license and not permit any more flights because no country can allow this kind of overflights over its capital. I mean, imagine if a Cuban plane would fly over Washington, D.C. airspace.
It would be blown out of the air immediately.
Exactly. So that's what the Cubans finally did, which is what President Eisenhower had essentially recommended to them back in 1959 when this problem first erupted, when Cubans were flying from Florida over Cuban airspace and then dropping bombs. And so Eisenhower said, why don't you just solve the problem yourself? Shoot them down. Well, the Cubans finally responded to his advice and shot two of the three planes down. Basulto returned unscathed to Miami on that trip. And from that incident, essentially resulted the prosecution of the Cuban Five.
Well, Saul, thank you so much for your time today. But one question I like to ask people when I'm talking about this issue is, to me, the blockade and the U.S. policy against Cuba is so anachronistic. It didn't make sense back in the 60s, and it certainly doesn't make sense now. Why do you think the blockade and the hostility of the U.S. Towards Cuba continues to this day?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One is that the U.S. imperial stance does not tolerate disobedience in its area. And Cuba's major crime, if you said, what did Cuba do to the United States? The answer was it was disobedient. It did not follow U.S. instructions. It behaved as if it was a sovereign and independent nation, which of course it is. But the U.S. doesn't like disobedience. That's the national security rationale. In addition, now you have an anti-Castro lobby that promotes the maintenance of the embargo and other punishing legislation against Cuba. So you have two forces now supporting this ridiculous policy. You know, you have to say, Cindy, it's only 53 years old, so give it time.
That's right. Saul Landau, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox and for your work. And I'll post a link to your film. And thank you for being so patient with my technical difficulties today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay. Talk to you soon, Saul. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That was the show for today. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Saul Landau, and I hope you check out his movie and his books and his website. Some people don't understand why I'm so interested in Cuba. Well, first of all, I'm a Cold War baby. I was born 2 years before the Cuban Revolution, and I grew up being told that Fidel was the devil, that Cuba was evil, and yeah, I have just experienced a totally different experience, I guess, on my many trips to Cuba. It's a delightful country. The people are wonderful and loving, and a lot of them are just as perplexed about Cuban-American relations as I am. You know, they're obviously not a threat to the United States. They're not a threat physically, but I think emotionally they are a threat because they give the threat of a good example about how a nation and a system does not have to be capitalistic or fascistic and still function. And they do function, but they would be able to function so much better if the blockade were lifted and relations were normalized. We have normal relations with Vietnam. Why can't we have normal relations with Cuba? I just don't get it. So anyway, I'd like to thank Saul Landau, our guest, for being generous with his time. And I hope you all didn't hear the technical difficulties, but I did have some technical difficulties. And I'm hoping to unveil a new soapbox at the beginning of the year. We'll be going into our fifth year, and I'm hoping to raise money to improve our equipment and to make it a more professional show and to work harder on the soapbox. And I'd like to thank Don DeBar, speaking of technical difficulties, because he's the one that has to smooth these things out as my engineer and as our connection to Community Progressive Radio. I'd like to thank my producer, Mikey. I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan, and you've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.